NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
The Flight Safety Detectives is bringing on a new sponsor, Piston Powered, a power-by-the-hour program for owners of piston-powered aircraft that can stabilize the long-term cost of owning your airplane.
Well, hello, gentlemen. It is another episode of Flight Safety Detectives. John and I are still stuck in D.C. doing stuff, so when you see this, we'll have probably already been home. But we wanted to get some information out since John and I are trolling Washington, D.C. We're getting some good information. One of the things that we want to talk about is get into a little more detail about the Washington midair, since that's where John and I are, and touch on Philadelphia, given the fact that the NTSB has recently found the cockpit voice recorder. However, when you look at the cockpit voice recorder, and given the fact that it was found at the bottom of an 8-foot, 9-foot crater, there is little hope or little chance that there may be usable information off of the flight data, or excuse me, off the cockpit voice recorder, that could lead investigators to make a determination as to why that Learjet departed controlled flight and then struck the ground at such a high rate of speed. But we'll touch on that here in a minute. We do want to get back to the events that are unfolding in DC. The NTSB has given out quite a bit of information for them, factual information that has come off the flight data recorder and some semblance of summary that has come off of the cockpit voice recorder. They have not given specific language or phrases and discussions, but they've alluded to the fact that the flight crew, when they were approaching the airport, were talking a variety of things. They heard some communication between the air traffic controller and the military Black Hawk helicopter. They didn't hear the Black Hawk response because they were on a UHF frequency and the regional jet pilots were operating on a VHF frequency. So they would have heard the tower controller making calls. They just would not have heard the military helicopter response. But getting into that, John and Todd, John, you know, one of the things that we've been talking about all day here before we started recording this is the fact that, of course, almost immediately after the accident, it was kind of a knee-jerk reaction. We're going to shut down all helicopter operations and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And I believe that that, unfortunately, isn't necessarily the right reaction that should have come out of this this particular accident thus far, because we don't know all the facts, conditions, and circumstances. We don't know what was going on. We don't know the context of a lot of this information. And to just shut down, especially this military operation, which is part of the national security plan, it is used not only by the military, especially Marine One, to go transport the president, but it transports dignitaries, it transports people of both the Congress and the Senate. And it's used by the National Park Service and law enforcement. So it has a variety of uses for navigating around Washington, D.C., which basically has a no-fly zone for low-level aircraft over the top of the nation's capital. So, John, I want to just turn to you And I know that Todd definitely has some comments as well with regard to some of the things that we're going to talk about. So, John, I'll turn it over to you real quick.
All right, so the knee-jerk reaction that we've seen from our leaders in Washington, and speaking of leaders, we should make it clear to the audience, if they haven't been watching, that the FAA is essentially leaderless, with the four top positions in the assorted silos, including air traffic control and flight standards, are empty. Those positions are empty. So we have a newly confirmed deputy administrator, and he's only days in the job, and he's going to have a little bit of knowledge overload coming at him. And but the other positions are occupied by temporary people, actors, the acting position. So right off the bat, there's a disadvantage in the leadership of the agency. And to add to that issue is Congress. All these congressmen who are getting hammered, by the way. I'm not saying that I disagree with Congress putting some leadership into this scenario, but they're getting hammered by a lot of people in a lot of different directions, and they're saying things that they never should say. And the White House is doing the same thing. And we need to, the industry needs a pause. We need to take a step back and take some meaningful changes, and they're quite simple, actually. And I'll let you talk about that, Greg, in a minute. They're quite simple for the immediate activity. For the long term, this may be an opportunity for the whole air traffic system to take a look at itself, because we have so many changing elements in the system today. People are hearing things about AI, and it may have a role, maybe I think a limited role in air traffic, but it also we're also going to be under the gun immediately with all these electronic devices that are flying. You know, it's not just little drones, they're going to be big drones, package drones. In fact, the bigger package delivery companies are saying they're going to have thousands of these flying. They're already flying in New York City space under exemptions. So there's a lot going on in under the radar, so to speak, of a lot of people. It's time that maybe we get in front of it as an industry and as a nation, and start looking at our system, because it's going to undergo some huge changes in just the next few years. And instead of playing catch up, why don't we get ahead of it and start thinking forward and being ready for it? So, having said all that, Greg, that's a good lead in for you to talk about what we've been discussing here in Washington about this route up the river.
And one of the things that came out right after the accident was they shut down operations for helicopters. And like I said before, I'm not sure that that was re absolutely necessary. This was not an airport congestion problem. Regardless of whether there's 500 aircraft or 800 operations a day going in and out of Washington National Airport, the fact is this accident wasn't attributed to to congestion. It was one aircraft. It was a helicopter and one airplane coming together at the wrong time, wrong place, unfortunately at the wrong altitude. So it is not a congestion issue. However, in light of that, immediately they stopped all helicopter operations. Now, while that is a nice band-aid fix and it made people feel good, it wasn't in the interest of national security, nor was it in the interest of basic, emergency response, emergency services, because the police department's there and the National Park Service, who's been flying over this accident site since day one, assisting. I mean, they're all operating along the Potomac River. We have no fly zones over the downtown area. You have to transit the area if you are a helicopter, low altitude, up the river. And typically, the route, and as Todd will show you, the route structure is very simple. It's not complex, it's very simple. Route 4 follows the shoreline, it joins to Route 1, it takes you beyond the airport. And as long as you stay on that flyway and below 200 feet, which is the maximum ceiling, we've never had a problem. We haven't had a problem in 50 years plus.
And let me, for the benefit of those who are listening to the audio version of this, describe what I'm showing the video version of this podcast. We had the helicopter route chart for the Washington, D.C. area. And toward the middle of the photo, you can see three runways. That's going to be Ronald Reagan National Airport. And the route that the helicopter in the accident was flying was the route one that goes along the Potomac on the Washington, D.C. side and merges to route four, pretty much opposite of the airport. And you can see there are a variety of helicopter routes going throughout Washington. The main ones are going up and down the Potomac and the, I believe, the Anacostia River, which is the one that branches off to the east. And you can see it's a fairly busy space. You have Andrews Air Force Base over on the right side of this map with the two long parallel runways. You have National Airport. And immediately above that, you have this blue rectangle area, which is the restricted area around the Washington Monument, the Capitol, the White House. And there's another restricted round area around the vice president's residence. So there are a lot of things that helicopter pilots have to avoid. And these routes are there to separate them from other traffic and from sensitive areas.
So we don't confuse the people. Route 1 and Route 4 have nothing to do with this Route 1 for automobile traffic or Route 4, because we have both of those roads in this area. So Route 1 actually, for the highway system, runs right through here, and Route 4 runs north and south right through here. So it's nothing to do with the highway marking system. These are focused solely on aviation.
And with all that being said, you know, the big issue is, again, we've had the ability to operate mixed traffic where we've had military rotorcraft aircraft, you know, in the same airspace as fixed wing traffic coming into and going out of Washington Reagan National Airport. And we've done it for over 50 years safely. We've never had a midair in that period of time until this past week or in the end of January. The fact is that to shut it all down, I think, was too much of an extreme, because there's a very simple solution. If you were to prohibit any kind of circle to land visual approach going into runway 33 at night, regardless of whether you are in the initial approach going to runway 1 or the initial approach going into runway 19, which is the same runway just coming from an opposite direction, if you are cleared to do a circle to land visual 233 from either one of those runways, it requires you to make turns so that you now position yourself to get on final. And it takes you right over either route 1 or route 4 or a combination thereof at low altitude as you are maneuvering to get on final for runway 33. During the day, you can see the traffic. You can see the traffic around you. You can see the traffic below you. The helicopters are very visible. And in fact, there's a number of videos circulating on the internet where people have taken pictures or videos out of the window as they're either landing or departing out of Washington Reagan. And you can see a two-ship formation flying those routes. It's great. Pilots can see it. And it's backed up by air traffic control and, of course, the TCAS equipment on the aircraft. The thing is, at night, it's a totally different environment. You cannot identify the difference between a regional jet and a Boeing 777. Why? Because you can't see the silhouette of the aircraft. All you see is their respective position lights. And when those lights at low level are being viewed from various angles and various altitudes, you can mistake the lights of the aircraft for the background lights of Anacostia, Alexandria, downtown Washington, a variety of things, even the airport environment. It can actually, you know, hide that aircraft because you don't see the silhouette, you don't see the outline of the airplane. And there are a number of optical illusions that we don't have time to talk about in this particular video. But if you are moving it at a speed and you're looking at an object that happens to be coming opposite to you, it may not look like it's moving in space. It looks like it's a fixed object. You may not identify it as an aircraft because it doesn't seem to be changing position as you're changing position either by speed and or by altitude or bank. So a lot of these things will factor in as human factors, but a very simple solution to allow helicopter operations to continue, I think, would be to prohibit circle to land visual approach to runway 33 at night. that's not going to really inhibit a lot of aircraft operations going into Washington and Reagan. Why? Because the period of time, you're talking well after sunset when it's dark, there's a curfew at that airport. So the arrivals and departures start to slow down as you get close to that curfew. During the day, you got high density. You got a lot of aircraft coming in, short periods of time and departing. That's great. People can see you. You can see them. That works. But you can still allow helicopter operations. You expect that they'll maintain operational discipline and stay in those low altitude routes. But you're not going to commingle any traffic by restricting or prohibiting the circle to land approach at night. You won't commingle the traffic going into Reagan because it requires the pilots to directly overfly. And not every pilot who is flying that circle to land approach is at a specific altitude. They aren't at 500 feet coming over the top of that route. Some aircraft may be higher, some aircraft may be lower, depending on how and where they started the approach. This way, you don't have to worry about it because you don't have aircraft overflying those routes at night. I mean, it's a very simple thing. Is it a long-term fix? Maybe yes, maybe no. But that at least allows the operations to continue. It does provide a level of safety, and it allows the NTSB to do its work. It allows the FAA to study the airspace without making dramatic, drastic changes. John, Todd, we know that any time something's come out of an accident where a dramatic or drastic change has been implemented, like right now, there's either a lot of pushback, a lot of consternation, or you have a variety of either alphabet groups or the airlines going, that's going to cost too much. We can't do that. We're not going to do that, or something to that effect. We know that whenever we make change, it should be incremental. Yes, we want to enhance or incrementally enhance safety, but dramatic change. You may lose sight by just blanketing saying we're not going to fly helicopters there. Okay, but what is that edict going to do to enhance aviation safety? Because you could have created not only new problems, but now how does it affect national security since those are important routes? Or how do you see or foresee the fact that you haven't just inhibited emergency response by aerial vehicles? So, I mean, it's a lot to digest, and John and I have talked about this past week. And John, I know that, you're the politically oriented person. I was just a technician investigator at the NTSB. You see it from a different perspective as far as the politics. So, again, I appreciate your comments because it's the politicians that are driving this. And we know from Continental Express, the political edict that came out of Congress about raising the minimum quals for a co-pilot in an airline to 1,500 hours and an ATP. I've not seen any quantifiable evidence that enhanced aviation safety.
And a little bit of background on that particular one. That happened to be the last time in the United States there was an airliner accident. They killed everyone on board. That was in 2009, shortly after the Miracle on the Hudson that happened within weeks of that. And before then, a first officer could join the ranks of a regional airline or even a major airline with 500 appropriate hours of experience. After that accident, one of the major changes, and like Greg said, perhaps not for the better, was it went up to 1,500 hours, which automatically made the cost of becoming someone at the lower rungs of the career from the civilian side much, much, much higher. And is there a pilot shortage because of that? One can argue. Is it a higher wall to climb in order to become a pilot? Certainly as a civilian-only pilot, not an ex-military pilot, much higher.
And again, I know 500-hour pilots that are better than 5,000-hour pilots. So, and people don't understand that in aviation, we don't use years of experience as a marker for experience. If you're an accountant and you've been in the business for 20 years, they go, wow, you're experienced because you've been 20 years in the business. We don't do that. We don't use that as a marker. We use flight time, hours of flight time as the marker, but it's the quality of those hours of flight time. If it's 500 hours of just droning around in the airport pattern just to accumulate time, that's not real experience because you're doing the same thing. If that's 5 hours of of 500 hours of flying all over in different environments, different airports, under different conditions. That's experience. And so we have to temper that. We have to be cautious of that. And sometimes, John, I don't think the politicians factor in all of those things that we in the business, we in the trenches, are actually responding to or reacting to.
So that's the role of the NTSB, to separate all these issues. And sometimes even the NTSB can get lost in the middle of all this, because there's more than one recommendation that has been made by staff that has with it unintended consequences. And sometimes they don't show up for months or years later. So they really need to be thought out and shaken out, as you mentioned earlier, Greg. And politicians, under these conditions, with the public and the news media hounding them, essentially, the tendency to make quick, rash decisions is natural. And other clearer minds, like the NTSB, have to be listened to in these kinds of situations. I'm not sure that they're going to listen in this one, because it seems at this point in time, the pressure that's on the public officials is very, very high. And that led in part to the knee-jerk shutting down of this Route 4. And now essential helicopters are going to fly over Alexandria, Arlington, and other areas, which only increases the risk. You know, just think about Sullenberg. If he didn't have the river, the outcome of that accident would have been considerably different.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah.
The pressure that is happening now is due, frankly, to where it happened and who was involved. This is in Washington, D.C. This is an airport that's used by the power brokers, military and civilian, that are in Washington, D.C. The media was all over this, like you wouldn't believe. Switch this around. Put the very same airport configuration, very same helicopter route configuration in Wichita, where this plane originated, versus D.C., and the very same accident happened, there would be an order of magnitude less political pressure on local officials and federal officials to do something.
No, that's a very good point, Todd. And again, it is the environment that we're operating in, and the fact that it happened in basically the nation capital backyard, where everybody can chime in because they can see it from the window of their office, basically. You know, the sad thing is that, again, you now have the highest levels of executive positions already declaring last week, right after the accident, almost the cause of the accident, which, one, is unheard of. Two, it's unprecedented, because the board cautions. When I was an investigator at the board, I cautioned all the parties. You cannot speak to the press. Any information that comes regarding this accident will be coming from the NTSB. Yet you have sources outside the NTSB who have already made some declarations. The concern is the board is independent. What happens if the facts, conditions, and circumstances that are developed during the course of the investigation are contrary to what has already been stated last week, but by the highest, you know, powers in the land, if you will, and it's contrary? Who wins?
Now, let me be not as diplomatic as you, Greg. I'll state for the record my opinion of one of those officials. I happened to be on a live interview when the president had the press conference the day after the event, and I listened to the entire press conference. His words at the beginning were quite appropriate, quite moving. And then, to his credit, he said something to the effect of, I have some pretty strong opinions and I'm about to give them. And he proceeded to give some pretty strong opinions based on the very limited data that was available there, and threw in a whole lot of other things that, frankly, I think had nothing to do with this accident. And certainly, he said things that were well in advance of any of the facts, data, and circumstances that the NTSB had coming, well in advance even of the first NTSB press conference, and will very likely be changed if he had a chance to, once the facts come out. And those facts may not come out for several months. However, he has the most powerful media pulpit in Washington, D.C., and his words reverberated around the aviation world and the world in general. And I can't help but imagine that having this kind of commentary would put stresses on people who are not even involved in the event, that don't have to be there. Now, John, off the air some days ago, shared with me his experience with a mid-air collision. There have been, prior to this one, from 1960 to 1986, there were seven mid-air collisions, all fatal, involving airliners in the United States. The last one was 38 years ago. The previous 26 years were seven, zero for 38 years until last week. John, you were involved with one of these in that you were the mechanic who released one of the aircraft on the flight that ended in a mid-air collision. Your actions, of course, had nothing to do with what happened at the end of the flight, but it definitely had an effect on you. If you wish, you could share that with us.
Well, you can't walk away from any of that. Before that airplane left Boston, that particular flight crew, both the pilots and the flight attendants, I talked to them extensively. It was early flight in the morning. They showed up early for their flight. They were there when we was finishing the last touches of the airplane to get it out. And I had interactions with all four of them. And a few hours later, I find out that the airplane crashed and killed them all. So emotionally and to just simply say it was a downer. It really pulled us down, pulled everybody down. So, I had nothing to do with what the events, but yet it had an effect on me and some of my coworkers. Just this week, flying down here to DC, my friends at the airport, I flew American Airlines. My friends at the airport, they were all in a funk. It's probably the simplest way to say it. They were in a funk. You could see it. You could see it in everybody. It pulled them down. So it affects everybody in the industry. Everybody. In fact, I often say in my presentations when we're talking about emergency response and so on, that with all our companies, big companies, thousands and thousands of employees, if you see somebody that and you work with, and suddenly an event like this happens, and they start behaving totally out of character, need to get them employee assistance because it could be an indication of things going bad. And I have some firsthand experience with that that came later in my working career with people that were not even associated with the events that were on the verge of doing something stupid personally. So,
Back when this happened to you, when this event happened to you, what resources, if any, existed for employees of the airline to deal with any potential mental health effects? Anything at all?
I don't believe we had anything. I think it came later.
Yeah. And again, I mean, we're in the business. We see the worst side of aviation on a daily basis is because that's really the foundation of our jobs. But we also see the positives and the changes that come out to enhance aviation safety. But as I said earlier, people are making a big case about congestion and the fact that it was a congestion accident. You had all these airplanes, you have all this, and that Reagan National Airport should have been closed a long time ago when they built Dulles. All of that is ridiculous discussion by people who really don't understand or not informed. But what it does do is form the basis for the next discussion about congestion. And that congestion is going to involve unmanned vehicles and eVTOLs, these air taxis, if you will. You want to talk about congestion and the potential, if not the reality, of an accident due to congested skies? Soon as we start putting up 6,000 package drones and you're starting to fly eVTOLs as you Ubers, in and around, city areas and things like that. That's congestion. That's the problem. That's the crisis. That's the air traffic system that's going to be saturated if we don't start to address it now and address the integration of those types of vehicles into the national airspace system. That's the discussion, not the fact that, there were 500 airplanes operating in and out of Reagan National in a day. That doesn't matter. What matters is what's going to happen in the very near future. We're not talking 20 years from now in the Jetson world. We're talking over the next 5 years, the steady increase of these unmanned vehicles and these eVTOLs operating in low altitude airspace, similar to those helicopter routes. That's going to be the problem.
Well, we've hit this one pretty hard. maybe we just leave it here, because we are going to do another show when more facts are available, and we're going to dissect this accident just because it was such a big major event into aviation and into the psychic of all of everybody that flies. I've getting emails all day long about friends of mine that are afraid to fly because of this. And I keep telling them you're going to be at higher risk going to the airport than you are going on the airplane. But sometimes it just doesn't sink in.
Yeah, well, we're going to have another show coming up where I'm going to invite both a very close friend and a colleague that is familiar to both John and Todd, who I had the good fortune of working with now since the days of ValueJet, because he was working for McDonnell Douglas when I met him. He is a safety pro. He is a safety advocate. He is just well studied when it comes to aviation safety. And we're going to talk about how the system failed. John, you talked about it in a couple of your interviews, where all of the safety things that we've tried to incorporate over the years, TCAS, SMS, all of those things that we've tried to do to enhance aviation safety, basically all failed for a variety of different reasons in this mid-air collision. And we're going to have Jeff on to get into the discussion about those failures and why those things may have happened and how we can learn from those failures to enhance safety going forward. But again, what effect is it going to have going forward once we start saturating the national airspace system with a variety of different flying machines, if you will, that are unmanned, that are going to be reliant on technology? And like you said, John, in the beginning, some AI and a variety of other things. So we're going to be doing that show. We're going to be recording it here in the near future. It's definitely going to be an interesting discussion, so stay tuned. So with that, Todd, I will leave you with our second to the last word.
Well, my second to the last word is about this accident, of course, but about the fact that there's going to be a long-term situation here. It will be months, maybe years, before the final report comes out, and maybe decades before we're finished mining this event for ideas that can prevent issues in the future. This was a crash, no question about it. This was a failure of all the safety systems that are built in, all the layers of protection, no doubt about that. This will change those layers of protection. Might add some, might subtract some. But that will not be done by rhetoric. It will be done by hard work behind the scenes. And just be patient is the only recommendation I can give to people.
Great. And John, with that, I will leave you with our last word.
So to all of our friends that are preparing to go flying in the near future, do a good job of pre-planning your flight. Do it at home or at the hotel before you go to the airport. Do it again at the airport. If they don't agree, dig deep and find out why. When they get out to your airplane, do a very thorough pre-flight. And I'm glad to say that I've been hearing from a number of people that they've been listening to what this little sermon is that I give at the end of every show, because they're telling me that they've reached out to mechanics and others and to find out how to do a better pre-flight than they were doing. And after you get in the air and flying today, this accident really highlights this, is you need to put that head on a swivel. You need to keep your eyes open to what's around you and what's going on. Was this particular crew in the helicopter distracted by something? We may never know that, but the possibility certainly exists that they were distracted by what they were doing with the goggles and maybe the instruction that was going on in this vehicle. Whatever the reason, distraction is a killer. So you need to stay focused on the job at hand, which is flying an airplane. So put your head on a swivel and really pay attention to see and avoid. And please, please fly safely.
Thank you for checking out our show. We really value our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you and how much you like it. So please give us 5 stars in your podcast platform.
We want to keep in contact with you. We are on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're on YouTube, we're really working on growing the channel, and it helps if you all send in comments. Please do that, and we read all the comments.
And be sure to subscribe. Remember, if you're in the market for aviation insurance, you can save 5% with Avemco just by mentioning our show. Visit them at www.avemco.com. That's it for this episode of the Flight Safety Detective. Until the next episode, fly safe.